Jesus begins this section that we're looking at this morning in verses 21 through 37 with the phrase, "You have heard that it was said." There's often a question as to what Jesus is actually addressing here. Is he actually changing the law itself, or is he changing the way his contemporaries have looked at the law? I rather opt for the second, but I also know that one of the things he's doing is he's deepening their understanding of what the intent of the law was supposed to be. He doesn't disregard it. He makes it different. He looks behind it as to what should be they should be thinking about. So he really deepens the commands. He doesn't, as he says in the earlier in that verse, he doesn't do away or abolish the law. He came to fulfill it. He reaches to the depths of our motivation here when he looks at murder, adultery, and swearing. And he doesn't just prohibit those things, although those are still prohibited, but he goes further. He gets to the very, shall we say, literally, to the heart of the matter. In one sense, I believe we could say what he commands here is addressing the symptom. The commands kind of address the symptoms. Jesus addresses the cure. Jesus gets down to the depths of where the infection really is. The causes of these things lie deep within the sinful human soul. And that's what Jesus is dealing with here. Let's take them one at a time and let's consider today not just the prohibition, but what's kind of behind it. What does he give us that helps resolve this situation? What Jesus is really telling us here, I think, is kind of a resolution for our anger and our contempt, as he tells us about murder, or at least he addresses the problem of murder. And so we see here not just a prohibition of murder, but a resolution to the deeper problem. Think about as you look at this first section, verses 21 through 26, there's a real liability issue here that he addresses. The liability is simply, he says, murder makes one liable to judgment, which is a truism that they knew, that he agreed with. But he takes it even further. He says, you know what else makes you liable to judgment? Anger makes you liable to judgment. Insults and saying, "You fool," create the same liability to judgment. Jesus adds a rather interesting little concept here. He says it makes you liable to the fires of hell when you do those things. That's a serious liability issue here. It's a serious responsibility that we have to those things. The root cause of them, I think Jesus is getting at here, is really contempt. Anger is bred from contempt, but it comes in many other forms and is caused by many reasons. George Bernard Shaw said, "Hate is the coward's revenge for being humiliated." Interesting way to put it, isn't it? Hate is the coward's revenge for being humiliated. Hate can be bred by religious, racial, or even economic bigotry. Or even educational bigotry. We're smarter than you. We're a different race than you. We're a better religion than you. Some simply have contempt for those who are weak. And I think contempt is kind of the brother of a condescending attitude. When we look at one another with a condescending attitude, we think we're better. We think we're smarter. We think we live in a better place. It all boils down to whether or not we have this condescending attitude toward other people, and we show contempt. Well, what's Jesus trying to replace all this liability with, which is kind of an interesting, if not seemingly counterintuitive kind of thing? I think in the long run, though, it really does make a difference. And that simply is reconciliation. What does he say the attitude you should have in all of these things? I think this is very interesting. He says, first of all, when someone has something against you, when they have contempt for you or hatred for you, go and be reconciled to that person. Don't allow those things to become barriers. Now, Jesus couches all of this, interestingly enough, in the setting of ritual as well as legal proceedings. Ritually, he says, if you're leaving your gift at the altar, and you know there's a problem between you and somebody, you go and before you give that gift on the altar, you go and make amends. You make things right between you and that person. He says when you have legal proceedings, you're more bound in a sense because you're going to end up paying the price for it, so you better, you sort of, have an out-of-court settlement first, which is, you know, a lot of what they do today is they sort of have these out-of-court settlements because if you go and you lose, you're really going to be liable. Your liability increases if you actually take it into the court system. So he has an interesting thing here that he puts it both in the ritual context between you and God and that person, as well as legal proceedings, which was very much a part of their culture, a part of their nation. What he reminds us here is that a person with anger and contempt stands condemned. When you have contempt for somebody, you stand condemned. A heart that prefers reconciliation cannot stay angry or contemptuous for very long. And I think that's the reason reconciliation becomes the cure. If you're a person who really prefers to be reconciled and to have friends rather than enemies, you see, then reconciliation is going to be the thing that you seek to do in all situations. Your anger won't last for long if you seek reconciliation. Forgiveness, both given and received, and Jesus, I think, addresses both of those, both if somebody has something against you or you have something against somebody else, forgiveness, both given and received, is at the very heart of reconciliation, isn't it? And so Jesus, I think, is ultimately asking, do you have a forgiving heart? Or would you rather hold on to your anger and your hatred and your contempt and your condescending attitude? Be a person who learns and desires reconciliation. You won't have a problem with murder if you do that. You won't also have a problem with your anger and your hatred and whatever other words you might use. Forgiveness is at the heart of reconciliation. The second point that Jesus brings up and the second thing that he addresses that's deep within the human soul is this problem of lust. Now, it exhibits itself as adultery. And of course, Jesus says, well, you've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. You see, adultery and divorce are kind of the symptoms of a deeper problem. And so Jesus really tries to show us here that adultery is a heart problem, a matter of our desires, a matter of what we love. Jesus calls it lust. And whoever looks with an inordinate desire, that's all lust is an inordinate desire, is adulterous. It probably puts a lot of us in that particular category because sometimes our thoughts cannot be controlled as easily as we might think. But you see, the seriousness of changing this inner mechanism is reinforced by his statement about your eye and your hand causing you to sin. What should you do if they do that? Well, Jesus is obviously using hyperbole here. He's making an exaggeration. We shouldn't literally cut out our eyes or cut off our hands. But it's a serious enough matter that if you have a choice between going into heaven or not, then it's better to lose one of those things. That's how serious this desire is. And Jesus seeks to change what we love or what we desire. Not just avoid, you know, the command, but really avoid the desire to disobey the command. You see, so Jesus is really deepening what we have here. He's really deepening. He's kind of getting to us where it really hurts. You know, deep within our souls are the things that we perhaps don't want to admit to ourselves or to other people. He does address the issue here of divorce. I think he puts it in here because it's sort of consistent with this whole question of adultery here. Divorce, we have to say, was not creation's intention. And I'm not going to go into great detail about what are right and what are wrong situations for doing that, because this is not the only place where Jesus and the New Testament addresses that issue. There are other places where the matter of divorce is discussed. This is not kind of the end of the matter. Jesus does mention in one of the other places in the Gospels where people ask him about it. He says it was because of the hardness of your hearts that Moses allowed you to divorce your wives and give them this certificate. See, so Jesus is really saying here, look, guys, the reason you have all this, first of all, is because your hearts are hard. It's a hard issue. Whether or not it's literally just because you want some other woman or because you just don't like the one you got, whatever the reason, it's hardness of heart. So he's addressing the problem deep within us. That's the problem that he gets to. Divorce had become, and I think it seems to me today, has become an acceptable way of life. Oh, well, you know, it's okay. We're dealing with it. If we come away with nothing else from this passage, come away with this fact. Divorce should be the exception, not the rule. And that's something we have to keep in mind because it has become so much of the rule today that I think it's certainly this here is a word of caution to us. But Jesus does give us an antidote to at least part of the problem here, doesn't he? The antidote to lust is purity. Have a pure mind. Think good thoughts. Blessed, Jesus says, are the pure at heart. And he may not be talking there just about lust, but he's talking about purity of thought and getting rid of evil intentions and evil thoughts within yourself. Listen to what the Apostle Paul says about the problem of sexual immorality in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 3 when he's talking to the church at Ephesus. He says, but sexual immorality and all purity or covetousness must not even be named among you as is proper among saints. It should not even be said that it's there at all. And if we back up further into Ephesians chapter 4, verses 18 and 19, he makes it very clear here also that sensuality and all kinds of immorality comes from, are you ready for this? Comes from a hardness of heart. Ephesians chapter 4, verses 18 through 19. Once again, you see, we have a heart problem. Sinful man has a heart problem. And so Jesus is essentially saying here, strive for purity of thought. Get rid of those thoughts. Do something else with them. Replace them with something else. Adultery and sexual immorality and lust and all of those things should be a thing of your old way of life before Christ. Something that you gave up. And I know it's a difficult task, but it's nonetheless, Jesus is telling us, change your desires. You change your desires, you won't have a problem with all those other things. Jesus deals with one other thing here, and that's oaths. You know, we're not perhaps in the habit of taking oaths. It's not something within our way of life, I guess, but maybe we do so kind of just sort of spontaneously every once in a while. This has a lot to do with our tongues, with our speech, which is an extremely important part of who we are, is it not? Swearing an oath affirmed your word with a curse for reneging. You know, I swear, in fact, one of the interesting things that you see in the Old Testament, it says, may God do so to me and more if I don't do such and such. They never actually say what they want God to do, but it's like, you know, they're still invoking God to do something to them, you know, if they don't go about doing what they say. I heard it said this way, or at least I read it this week, swearing is a pathetic confession of our own dishonesty. You know, we have to swear because, you know, we have to sort of convince everybody we're really telling the truth. You know, Jesus goes on to say here, don't take an oath by heaven, earth, or Jerusalem, or don't take an oath by your own head. I'm not sure what he means by that, but I kind of wonder if it isn't something like this old phrase, you know, cross my heart and hope to die. You know, we used to say that as kids, cross my heart and hope to die. Well, you know, do you really have any control over whether or not you will die if you don't do that? And Jesus says, well, you don't have any control over your oath. You can't make your head white or not by your statement. So what's the point of even swearing by those things? It's nothing you can control. There's sort of an implied here, you can control the way you speak, you can't control any of those other things. Matthew 23, verses 16 through 22, Jesus demonstrates how the Pharisees had perverted the true meaning of the law. What they said was, if you swear by the temple, well, you're not liable for that. But if you swear by the gold in the temple, well, then you're liable for your oath. Or if you swear by the altar, you're not liable for your oath. But if you swear by the altar, or you swear by the gift on the altar, then you're liable. And Jesus says, you know, you guys are really idiots. Now, he doesn't use that term, but he says, you guys are so, you're such hypocrites. You know, that has not, you can't start ferreting, that was not the intention of the law. You can't start trying to ferret out what's a good oath and what's a bad oath. It wasn't meant to be a prohibition against lying, or it was meant to be, I should say, a prohibition against lying and perjury. It's like not, you know, do it one way, you're okay. Do it another way, you're not okay. Jesus is simply trying to say the law was trying to get us not to lie or not to perjure ourselves. It's not simply a mean, it wasn't simply meant to be a means of swearing properly. But I still like that swearing is a pathetic confession of our own dishonesty. That's really what it is. We have to prove to everybody somehow that, or try to prove that we're speaking truth. The cure simply is to speak truthfully all the time from your heart. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. You know, it's the old give somebody a handshake and, you know, my word is good because I shook hands and I said so on the deal. This means simply to be a person of integrity of speech. James chapter 5:12. He repeats pretty much verbatim the same formula that Jesus uses here. Above all, my brothers, he says, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no, no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. That's right out of the Sermon on the Mount that James takes up the same concern. Anything else comes from a fundamentally deceitful disposition. It's a heart problem. As always, it's a heart problem. Unadorned by exaggeration or oaths, yes and no should still mean something to us. And our word should still mean something to us. If you are not going to do something, don't say you are. If you are going to do something, you better follow through. It's a simple matter of being honest. The cure, speak truthfully. I would conclude with several things on this section. Number one, the cure for anger and contempt is to be a person who seeks forgiveness and reconciliation in all things. Romans chapter 12 and verse 18 says, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with all men. And I realize there are limits to that. You just may not ever live at peace with certain individuals. But as far as it depends on you, you see, be a person of forgiveness and a willingness to reconcile. The cure for adultery depends similarly on a changed heart. Get rid of the impure thoughts that you have. Defilement, Jesus tells us in Mark chapter 7 and verses 21 through 23, resides within every human heart. It's not something you take in, it's not something external, it's what's inside. For from within, Jesus says, out of the heart of man come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, and he goes on and on and on. It's all something inside our hearts. And so we have to change what we really desire, what our affections are, what we love, what we want to do, what our plans are. The antidote to lying is not swearing, but simply being a person of truth. A person of truth has a heart of integrity. And a person of integrity doesn't need to prove the veracity of his speech because he is known to be a person of integrity. And that's what Jesus is dealing with. You see, let's sum it up by saying this. A better world begins when we change ourselves. That's where it starts. By changing yourself, you've already changed the world a little bit. And how many times have we said in our class on Sunday morning, you can't fix everybody else, you can fix you. And that's what Jesus is saying here. Jesus demands that these changes begin with the fundamental problems that we have as sinful human beings. Anger, adultery, lying. You got to change what's inside your heart. We are blessed, are we not, that the gospel breaks that spell of sin for us. And you can decide for or against it for yourself. The gospel of Jesus Christ, his death, burial, and resurrection came to break the hold that all of those things have on us. And so when we've made that commitment, by expressing our faith, by becoming baptized for the remission of sins, we have said that we want the spell of those things to be broken for us. And we have said to God and to others that we're going to live our lives in a way that's consistent with that now. Some of that is what Jesus says here. That's part of kingdom living. And so we encourage today, all of us, to either accept the gospel for the first time or to continue recognizing that it is these changes that need to happen in our lives. Let's make it a point to do that this week. And let's stand together and sing to make sure that commitment is good for each of us.